This is CSAP's Science and Policy Podcast from the University of Cambridge, where we're bringing you the latest evidence and expertise to improve public policymaking. Hi, I'm Rob Doubleday from the Centre for Science and Policy, and in this week's episode of CSAP's Science, Policy and a Green Recovery podcast, we're going to be talking about the macroeconomic shock from the COVID pandemic and how that relates to arguments for investment in a green recovery. We'll be talking to two economists from the University of Cambridge to help us understand where we are and possible paths to a better future. So I'd like to welcome Camille Mahadis, who's a senior lecturer in the Cambridge Judge Business School, whose work is on economics and policy, and also Nina Seeger, who's from the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership, where she's the Research Strategy Director for Sustainable Finance. Welcome to you both. Can I start with you, Camille, because I know that you have recently published a working paper that's looked at the macroeconomic shock from the current COVID crisis and attempted to forecast into the future how different countries are going to fare. Could you just tell us something about the kind of methodologies used and most interestingly, what you think this means for different countries as they navigate the economic fallout of the pandemic?
Absolutely, absolutely. So as you know, the COVID-19 pandemic is an unprecedented shock. It has a global reach and its impact is immensely unprecedented. And because of this unprecedented nature of the shock, it has a supply side effects, it has a demand side, it has uncertainty sides. I mean, it becomes very difficult for policymakers to assess the shock, the implications of the shock, the consequences of the COVID shock. And it also poses a big question for us economists in terms of how do we empirically analyze the direct and indirect effects of the shock in a global economy which is heavily interconnected.
How did you analyze it?
We identified the shock by looking at IMF forecast revisions. So we look at what IMF thought how the world would look like at the end of 2019. And then we looked at their forecast in April 2020, when they released the World Economic Outlook. We identified the COVID-19, country-specific COVID-19 shocks. And we used basically a compact model of the global economy with 33 economies, about 90% of global GDP, to understand the impacts of this COVID shock on these economies, while at the same time taking into account the interconnections between the economies, the spillovers through trade linkages, through commodity channels, etc. I think the one important thing we also did was we tried to take into account the nonlinear effects of this shock, mainly through this global volatility channel. So we know that global volatility could dampen economic growth consequently, and that's basically one important thing that we model in this compact model of the global economy.
So what's the headline in terms of the forecast for the next couple of years? What do you anticipate for the global economy?
We have a couple of very important findings, actually. One is, this is a counterfactual exercise. So what is the world with COVID and what would it have been without the COVID shock? And what we show is that actually this pandemic will reduce real GDP by about 3%, below, if you want, a model-generated path without the shock. And this is by the end of 2021. So our model is quarterly. So this is 2021 Q4. And what we show is that while China and other emerging Asian economies are expected to be affected less severely, in fact, the US and the UK and several of the advanced economies will experience a much deeper and longer lasting effects. And one key thing here is among the non-Asian emerging market economies, the impact could be substantial, but it will depend obviously on domestic factors such as health preparedness, lockdowns, economic structures, but also because of their external disturbances such as collapsing tourism in many of the countries, capital outflows, falling commodity prices in Latin America and the Middle East, and plunging trade. But there is significant heterogeneity, but what we observe on average, the global economy would be 3% below what it would have been without the shock. One important thing we find, actually, is that the spillovers, it's very important to take into account these spillovers. And we look at Sweden in particular. Sweden, as you know, always in the news, New York Times is covering it pretty much on a daily basis because of its less stringent strategy. And what our results show is that no country is immune to the economic fallout of the pandemic because of these global interconnections. That's one of the key things. You cannot escape COVID, even though you follow a less stringent strategy and therefore, you know, the economy might not be affected. But actually, because of our interconnections, it will be affected. One last thing I think our results show is on interest rates. We show that long-term interest rates are actually likely to be about 100 basis points below their historical lows in advanced economies. But the word of caution is for emerging market economies, where the uncertainty about the interest rates, in particular range, is that there's a huge and substantial significant upside risk. So a word of caution on the interest rates. But overall, the global economy will be hit relatively hard because of this COVID shock. In other words, we don't observe this V-shaped recovery in our counterfactual analysis.
So this is really very important as we return to the sort of core theme of this series, which is how do policymakers respond to the need to invest in order to meet climate change commitments and address other kinds of ecological crises? And so I suppose the question to put to you, Nina, is the dire picture that Camille is painting, is that a call to action so that we can see governments and investors respond by investing in creating a green economy that we need anyway? Or is the depth of the economic challenge going to turn people to sort of shorter term questions about investment for shorter term job creation? I mean, that's a big question, Nina. What's your sense as you see it?
Well, I'm afraid it's not an either or, but probably a both type of answer. I think from the first perspective, if you look at how the COVID shock had spread, you can think of it as an effect, as a climate stress test of sorts. So if we were to see an abrupt transition of the economy towards a much more sustainable trajectory, then we would have seen hits in fossil fuels, we would have seen hits in airlines, and that is very much what has happened during the corona crisis. So on the one hand, we can see it as almost a forewarning of what could happen if we don't manage the transition really carefully, if we don't invest now, if we don't look for a gradual move towards a sustainable net zero economy. On the other hand, I think you are right in the sense that COVID crisis is presenting a little bit of a problem in terms of the available budgets. If you think of the trajectory that the sustainable finance was going towards the crisis, we've seen huge growth. We've seen lots of financial institutions thinking about and starting to incorporate climate-related and wider environmental sources of risk. With the COVID crisis, we will see first an economic hit, then a somewhat delayed financial crisis, because effectively there's always kind of a lag on these things. And that will restrict the ability of financial institutions and corporates to invest. Hence, we can go into the green recovery plans.
Just before the pandemic hit, there was a sense that investors around the world were really starting to take seriously climate change. And there was evidence, I believe, Nina, you can tell us, of actually, you know, sizable shifts in investment strategies among some around the world and also in central banks. How have those shifts then played out as we've seen the shock from COVID?
Well, that's quite interesting as well. So effectively, we have seen commitment to climate so far go through the crisis. We've also seen quite some interesting results around the performance of sustainable companies, funds, and indices. So if you look at the BlackRock study that looked at the performance of sustainable funds and indices, they've seen that sustainable indices, I think in 94% of sustainable indices, outperformed their parent indices over the first quarter. Now, you can argue that there are three reasons for this. Number one, they are, in effect, it's their composition, right? So you have a large technological component usually of a SASTI index. You have a pharma component. Those are the industries that have done relatively better in comparison to having the airlines and the fossil fuels. The second part is there was an inflow of funds towards sustainable funds through the first quarter. So that had helped as well. But I think the much more interesting component and a much more basic one is that we have seen that sustainable companies have performed better through the crisis. The reasons for this is that when they go through sustainability rating process, they go through their supply chains, they understand who their counterparties are, they have better information systems, they have more clear board governance. All of those things were fundamentally helpful through the corona crisis, knowing who your counterparties are, knowing where your supply chains are, knowing how they're set up and being able to navigate them. All of those things were fundamentally helpful. And that's not only work by BlackRock that underlined this, but also there is a working paper, as yet unpublished, by Julia Meyer and Ola Mahmoud, who are talking about, it's an academic study, analyzing the performance of sustainable companies. And they come to similar conclusions that indeed they see outperformance through the COVID crisis, and then they decompose it into different parts. So I guess there is a little bit of light through the crisis, because in effect, it has given us also a practical life example how a sustainable company is more resilient.
And Camille, I'd be interested to get your perspective, because I know that previously you've also looked at the economic costs that could be expected from global climate change and increased variability of climate that we could anticipate in the coming decades. Do you feel that the sort of COVID economic shock is like a model or an advance warning of the kinds of economic shock we can expect, or is it something different?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, in work with colleagues at the IMF and USC and here at Cambridge, we do show that the climate change will pose significant stress on various economies. And, you know, not like most studies will say actually climate change will be costly for hot and poor countries. We actually show that climate change is perhaps a more of an issue for advanced and cold countries, precisely because there are, you know, for instance, Canada, although the global, under an RCP 8.5 scenario, the global temperatures are increasing by 4 degrees relative to today, for instance, what we observe is that in Canada, they will actually increase much faster. So this will pose a much bigger problem on the Canadian economy, and the losses could be substantial. So if you allow for this climate variability and temperature variability along the path to these higher degrees by year 2100, we show that the global economy could be between 7 and 15% poorer than would have been in the, you know, if we were able to follow through with the Paris Agreement, say, where we contain the temperature increases to 1 degree Celsius from today. So yes, we do show that. But I think the problem is that, you know, in phase one of this recovery, globally, I mean, the G20, I think, have committed something like $13 trillion to these recovery plans, of which I think Vivid Economics calculated somehow that, you know, 3 to 4 trillion could be associated with sort of green recovery. And then they show that out of the 20 G20 economies, 16 of them, the commitments actually have leads to higher emissions than would have been the case. So this kind of green recovery, these economies are talking about, but actually what they're committing these funds to are sort of non-green recovery plans. And I think that's kind of important and probably understandable, because in the first phase of the recovery, policymakers are more concerned, I believe, with creating jobs and protecting people's lives and livelihoods. And therefore, perhaps the green recovery will not be where in that initial phase. In the second or third phase, when the economies are opening up and we're slowly adjusting to this post-COVID era, then I think the policymaker can start thinking about, is it green or is it not so green recovery? And I think what Vivid Economics is doing is showing basically in the first phase, where we are committing all these trillions of dollars to recovery plans, majority of which are not being spent on a green recovery. But, you know, how it plays out over time, and I think as we come out and, you know, things, we start living in this post-COVID world, it will be very important to see how this money is spent. Because you hear green recovery everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you hear it from the European Commission to the UK government and elsewhere in the world. But I don't think in their plans we do see that.
I mean, it'd be interesting to I mean, Nina, you should come in a second. But just to summarize where we've got to, I mean, the argument that you two have made so far is that the long-term macroeconomic challenge from the COVID pandemic is really significant and will be with us for several years at least.
Absolutely.
The economic challenge that we can anticipate from ecological crises that we can foresee, whether that's climate or others, will also be very significant and will play out over decades. Nina, you've talked about the fact that there's evidence that sustainable firms, sustainable investments perform relatively well. But Camille, you make the point that from a government's point of view, they've got a sort of short near-term set of policy concerns and the longer-term policy concerns. And so the question is, how do governments with limited funds, limited political capital respond? And the way you set it out, Camille, of course, by saying there will be a temptation for governments to deal with near-term issues first, create jobs, any jobs, and we'll defer questions about a green recovery till the next phase. And we all know that there's a significant risk that tomorrow never comes. So that's my kind of summary of where we've got to. But Nina, cheer us up.
So I'm going to agree with the first part of what Camille said and disagree with the second. I think on the first part, on climate variability, it is very, very, very important. And not only for the developed economy. So we did two pieces of work on embedding environmental scenario analysis in South Africa and in Mexico. What we saw there is very similar to what Camille is saying. So even if we hit 1.5-2 degree warming, places like South Africa will hit much higher warmings, which means more physical impact and less ability to absorb that physical impact. And we've seen a variety of studies around how different physical source of risk could impact credit sovereign ratings and what can we do about it. So I think there are issues for developed economies. There are a multitude of issues for emerging economies, and we really need to be quite careful and quite supporting in thinking how we can help those economies address those issues and move through the just transition. Because in effect, we're not going to be able to transition just the UK or just the European Union. We need to do it as a single globe. So that's my agreement sorted. Now, the more interesting bit is this. There have been studies after the financial crisis that had analyzed the potential for green recovery plans. So for example, Hauser et al. That said that actually green recovery brings, especially investments in renewables, investments in infrastructure, bring more jobs and more growth. So if the governments indeed look at, let's create any jobs, that's a less effective measure than putting in a green recovery plan that will stimulate the economy better than a non-green plan would. So effectively, I think we need to be really careful. I agree with Camille that we need to actually see evidence of the plans and we need to see them tied to particular targets. It's one thing to talk about we're going to have a green recovery. It's another thing to say we're going to use this investment if you follow a particular plan, and that plan means transitioning. Right? So I think we need to be, number one, careful about what we talk about when we talk about green recovery. But number two, I see much more incentive to pursue a green recovery than to pump the money into the economy throughout without kind of thought. And we're going to publish a piece of work done in collaboration with Women in Business and with Cambridge Econometrics in the next couple of weeks, which looks at different green recovery plans for different countries under different scenarios and actually analyzes what that might mean.
Great. Well, we'll certainly make sure to share those publications when they come out. Camille, I mean, if you follow Nina's observations, do you see policymakers at kind of national level are grappling with these kind of issues? And obviously, your work suggests that quite obviously different countries are going to be looking at different kinds of challenges. Do you see any grounds for Nina's optimism?
I mean, I completely agree. This is, we usually take this UK view and our US or Western view of climate change and climate change policy. I think it's a global issue. And obviously the COVID shock, which is unique, like a climate shock, it's global in nature, will affect everybody and will have a negative impact on everybody, regardless of how resilient you are. So I think I agree with that. The problem, I suppose, is, I mean, you can make a comparison with oil exporters. I spend a lot of time talking to policymakers in oil exporting economies. And every time there is a negative shock to oil prices, you hear these grand plans of diversification, grand plans of moving away from oil. You know, we saw it following the financial crisis. We saw it following the shale oil revolution in 2014-16. And we saw it recently with the COVID shock. But what you notice is that actually there is very little move to changing, you know, away from this oil dependence towards a diversification program. I mean, in name, it looks very good. We have all these Vision 2030 and Vision, you know, 2025. But actually in practice, we don't see them come through. And I think really there is a conflict between what policymakers want to do in the short term and elected officials want to do in the short term, which is, you know, following COVID, preserve livelihoods, and what they're thinking about will happen by 2050. But Rob, you're absolutely right. By the time we think about what will happen in 2050, it's already too late. You know, we need to take action right now. But I just don't see that. If you look at the commitments of these recovery plans, all these fiscal stimulus that has been in there, the evidence is that a lot of it is not in green recovery. I mean, it's great news that, you know, $3 trillion have, you know, it looks like they're being devoted to reducing our emissions in various sectors like agriculture, transportation, etc. The bad news is there is another, you know, 12 to 13 trillion that's been devoted in other, you know, polluting industries. So I think there is a trade-off. Also, I come back to this performance of the firms with high ESG scores. I'm really fascinated with that. Actually, we're working with some colleagues to try to understand that. But it's not clear to me that is telling us that investors are seeing a risk in climate. You know, are they seeing that climate change will have a risk? Therefore, these sort of high score ESG firms are better to invest in? Or is it simply because those firms with higher ESG scores are just more resilient? And, you know, it's not that they invest and therefore they're outperforming the ones that are not. So I think an interesting question is, it's not just in terms of policy, but what are investors doing? Are they perceiving this shock as the start of something bigger and therefore move away to sustainable investment?
I mean, I think investors don't have a choice anymore. So if you, for example, read the Bank of England's Dear CEO letter from July this year, it effectively said, we expect you to manage climate-related financial risks by the end of 2021, which had effectively moved the implementation table for a lot of the work that's currently being done on the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures from sometime in 2022 to sometime relatively immediately, because effectively they've got, at least the banks have about 15 months to sort it out. We also, I think, see with the flow of money into sustainable funds, the general investment community starting to talk about it. And in a number of conversations we're having with different institutions, anecdotally, there is a lot of conversation around the questions that they're getting about their ESG performance, about what they're doing and what they're not doing. So I'm actually heartened is the wrong word, but I think that the climate-related financial risks are moving in the right direction. To be honest, my worry is a little bit about nature-related financial risks, because on the one hand, COVID had brought quite a lot of attention to the fact how we can have, you know, zoonotic-driven pandemics, how nature is important. On the other hand, if you see a constrained budget of an institution, and they can only devote only so much time and resources to particular issues, that budget is likely to go to climate rather than biodiversity loss and land degradation. However, arguably, a lot more work needs to be done on biodiversity loss and land degradation, because those issues will actually help climate and help us avoid a much, much bigger crisis that we're facing.
I think there is also an interesting thing is in that in this crisis, what has happened is that in previous recessions or in previous crises, what we observed was that the service sector picked up very fast and manufacturing lagged. What we are observing now is manufacturing actually is picking up super fast. So let's say manufacturing has a V-shaped recovery, whereas services are actually lagging behind because of the nature of obviously the transmission of the coronavirus. And I think that also contributes to emissions in the short run that we will observe. You know, we had this great thing that emissions fell significantly because everybody was landlocked, you know, or were sitting at home. And then slowly we're seeing these emissions going up. So one interesting thing is to see how can we think about services, in a green recovery in terms of services. Can we think about, bringing back services in a way that actually, like Nina was saying, contributes? I don't know whether policymakers are thinking in those terms, or they are just desperate to get service sector back online.
So in the final minutes, I mean, I would like both of you to address your sort of comments to policymakers. So people who you can imagine working intensely hard at the moment and aware that they need to be taking action now for the short term, but wanting, I'm sure, to be doing so in ways that are also going to, deliver for a greener recovery over the long run. I mean, that's surely many people's aspirations, even if it's difficult to do. So Camille, what would, be your practical suggestion as a way to kind of help people think about acting for the short term in ways that actually, are making the right decisions for long-term investments for a green recovery?
I mean, I think the lesson you can get from a recent study on the macroeconomic effects of the COVID shock is that, what is really important is a comprehensive and coordinated cross-country response to the pandemic, which is also true in a climate change scenario. So in the COVID case, I think once we have effective treatment, that it's distributed quickly out and, get people back out and working. But and I think one short-term thing is we need to have clear policy interventions to make sure that the financial markets are functioning normally. I think that's really key to support the individuals, firms, households, etc. But there is also something that we're learning here is that policymakers need to learn to manage this risk. And this COVID-19 crisis shows that I don't think we are prepared for a climate change related risk. And how do we do that? And how do we align our incentives? Well, I mean, I think one incentive is it will be extremely costly if we don't deal with the climate change issue today and tomorrow and just leave it and postpone it, because we really want to have this quick recovery following the COVID shock. In other words, we shouldn't be tempted to go back to normal. We should go to a new normal where we do have, as Nina said, incentives to invest in green jobs and in the green recovery. And in doing so, it might be what Nina is saying as well, maybe the green multiplier, the green fiscal multiplier, is actually larger than the non-green fiscal multiplier. And all these efforts ultimately will limit the scarring of the economies today and by year 2100, whatever will happen then.
Thanks. Thank you very much. And Nina, what's your kind of practical message that you'd like to leave people with?
So if I think about the takeaways, I think number one is tie any recovery funding that is available to green and sustainability targets to ensure that, number one, that the recovery is sustainable, but to also to benefit from better performance in terms of job creation and in terms of a more sustainable economy at the end of it. I think number two, keep in mind both the climate-related and the nature-related financial risks, because in effect, we've had a little bit of a taste of what a shock, an abrupt transition could look like. And we'd really like to avoid that if at all possible. So let's work on managing those risks. Let's work on a targeted recovery. And I think number three, let's also understand that we need to work together towards a single sustainable future. And that also means addressing social factors. It means addressing just transition. And I think that is an issue that has been brought home quite well by the COVID crisis. And if I leave it on a positive, I think we have all seen the technological transformation that has enabled all of us to be online, on video calls in the last 4 months. So some organizations have gone through a technological transformation that would have taken 5 years in the space of 3 weeks. Let's utilize the thinking and the creativity and the innovation behind that to move towards a much more sustainable future.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly left with the very clear diagnosis of the kind of challenge and problems that policymakers are facing. And we sort of have a sense of the direction we all ought to be moving in, but it's just going to be how to get that coordination and alignment when there are going to be sometimes competing challenges and drivers on policymakers. But it's very, very helpful to have it so clearly set out what the potential upside if that kind of alignment can be achieved. So thank you very, very much for joining us.
CSAP's Science and Policy Podcast is a production of the Centre for Science and Policy at the University of Cambridge. This series is produced in partnership with Cambridge Zero. This episode was hosted by me, Rob Doubleday, and was produced by Kate McNeil. You can learn more about CSAP's work by visiting us on Twitter at CSIPOL or at our website, www.csap.cam.ac.uk. If you have any feedback about this episode or questions you'd like us to address in a future week, please email inquiries@csap.cam.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.